Bringing the internet to new places around the world is important, but it's also very challenging and perhaps even a daunting task as well. So with us today is a very special guest, Darwin Costa, who has spent years and years doing just that, working with service providers, submarine cables, technical leaders around the world to bring higher speed, higher quality internet connectivity to new places where there really wasn't anything significant prior. So in today's episode, we're going to dig into Darwin's experience, hear some success stories, some challenges that he faced, and also learn a little bit about how Darwin went from being a pro soccer player to the prolific network engineer he is today. My name is Philip Gervasi, and this is Telemetry Now. Darwin and Doug, it is great to have you both on the podcast today. Darwin, getting to see you for the first, actually, I think we met once before over Zoom, so for the second time. And then Doug, of course, it's always a pleasure to speak to you. Now, I understand that you and Darwin actually have a long relationship and you've been friends for quite a while. So why don't you take it from here, Doug?
Sure. Thanks, Phil. So as you mentioned, I'm Doug Vidori, the Director of Internet Analysis at Kentek, and we've got Darwin Costa, presently at DKIX, an old friend of mine, and we've been talking about internet and submarine cables for a number of years. Darwin, would you introduce yourself and talk about like where are you at now and your role at DKIX?
Yeah, sure. And first of all, thanks guys for the invitation. I really appreciate that. You know, good to be here on the podcast with you guys. So yeah, like Doug said, you know, we know each other from previous lives, I would say. My previous life is previous life. So I was working for Angola Cables for 7 years, and we were actually deploying subsea cable, the first and unique subsea cable between Angola, Africa, and South America. And then eventually in 2019, I joined DKIX, and I do look over activities in Africa and Latin America as an interconnection lead person.
So I want to tell, we'll have to tell the SACs, the South Atlantic Cable System is the cable Darwin's talking about, and tell that story. But before we get into that, Darwin, can we, let's talk about your, you know, where did you come from? Where did you, how did you get into computers? What, or this industry, like, bring us back to the beginning. So you grew up in Angola, is that correct?
Yeah, right. I think it's always good to start with that. You know, that's an often question which is not asked, actually, you know, and let's go into it, because I do face a lot of problems when people ask me, where are you from? You know, because eventually they will think I'm a Brazilian, I'm from Egypt or from Morocco. But no, I was born and raised in Angola. And then, yeah, in the capital city of Luanda. And then eventually Angola was a country with 30 years of civil war, you know, and on my young ages of elementary school, you know, I always like to hang out at school, you know, doing some homework and hang out with friends and play a lot of soccer, you know. So my mother used to actually beat me a lot because I was more into soccer than anything else. Then eventually, you know, the war broke out into the capital city, and I was young, and luckily I could play some football, and I told my mother, hey, why don't you send me somewhere, you know, maybe I can do something for the entire family, you know, in the future. And then eventually I went to Spain, to Gran Canaria. That was the first country I ever went when I was a young child and playing football.
How old are you at this?
I was something like 11, 12 years old, and I was wow. playing for the, was already playing for the national team of Angola, 115 years old age, and we went to a football tournament, which is a tournament which is called the World Cup, you know, for young children, and then eventually we went to Gran Canaria, and I did play it well, you know, and then one of the scouts was there, and he told my grandfather, because my grandfather was with me, and he told me, you know, he told can you leave your grandson over here with us, you know, so to play some soccer and to develop and to grow further. And then eventually I told myself, you know, I said, shit, I need to buy a gift for my mother so she allows me to stay in Spain. Eventually I did that. And when I got back home, she said, you know what? You are going nowhere. You are made for school, so you need to go to school. Okay. And then, you know, my dream, my grandfather's dream was like falling apart. But as far as the war was getting worse, you know, she really thought, you know, I need to send him somewhere. And then I had someone, an uncle of mine, he was living in the Netherlands back then. And I always watched these kind of movies of the football schools in the Netherlands. And I said, hey, this is kind of cool. Why not, right? So I did went to the Netherlands, you know, and I did some kind of, these tests that they have in the summer, in the winter. Unfortunately, I came into the winter time and it was freezing cold, you know, and I couldn't do anything, you know, I was just not used to it. And so my uncle said, you know, let's wait for the summer. It's more your kind of weather, you know. And then eventually I went to a first division club and, you know, things went well. And they said, you know, you can stay in here. But on the other side of the ocean, you know, on the other part of the continent, my mother was always beating me up over the phone. You need to go to school. Don't drop school. School is important, you know. And, you know, it's totally a different world when we talk about internet and then professional sports. But one of the things that I learned a lot, and I'm very thankful that I did both at the end of the day, was really discipline, you know, because discipline is very, very important, you know. And although I wanted to become a football player, I knew I need to do something with my studies. And then eventually I liked a lot video games. I think all of us did, you know, in some certain point in our lives, you know, Sega Mega Drive, Atari's and whatever, you know. And so I said, hey, this is fun, you know, so why don't I do something with computers? And, you know, back then computers were just coming up, you know, and all of these. I think one of the first courses I did back then was the CCNA, the Cisco one, you know, it was all new to me. But I had fun, you know, opening the PCs and having a new motherboard and doing stuff with the PCs, a new memory and blah, 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 you know. And so eventually, and long story short, in 2009, I was selected to train with the senior national team in Angola. I went down to Angola, had my trainings, and then I was selected to play for the Africa Cup, which was played back then in 2010 in Angola. Unfortunately enough, I got malaria when I got back home, and so I was 2 weeks, you know, in the 2 weeks in the hospital, and I actually had two choices, you know, just finish school, which was about 5 months to get it done, university. Or I would try to recover, you know, and then eventually go back to football again. But, you know, I just followed whatever my mother said, you know, school is important. That's what I did, you know. And
So in the Dutch system, I feel like maybe you told me once you made it to the second, you made it the second division pro team. Which team was that?
Yeah, it's a team called, I will do it in English and then in Dutch, because in Dutch you say it AGOVV, but in English you said AGOVV. That's what you call it.
Okay.
It was a team where I played with guys like, I will give you a name, he's still a good friend of mine, but Dries Mertens is playing for the Belgian national team, you know. Yeah. So yeah, we all grew up over here, you know, because the first division team where I used to go when I was young was called Vitesse. In another city. But eventually when you get a little bit older and they don't have any kind of responsibility with you anymore when it comes to school, right? So I wanted to do both. And in order to do that, I needed to go to training and go to schools during the night or whatever, you know. I needed to do my own scheduling. And that's what I said, you know. I think discipline was really key to me, you know. And I didn't want anybody fell down, especially my mother, you know. And, you know, eventually, you know, you make a lot of friends in the sports industry, as you guys might know, because in US the sports industry is huge, right? If you watch to an NBA game, even the MLS right now, it's kind of crazy, right? So when you have these kind of dreams, you know, and when you don't go to school and things actually don't unfold as you would like, then things become a little bit worse, right? So I do have friends which are still playing, but I do have friends which are, you know, just working in a factory. Nothing sure. bad against that, but it's just life, right?
I'd say that, you know, at conferences that Darwin's a popular guy. He's a very cool dude, and a lot of people want to hang out with him. And I think he's also too humble to talk about the fact that he was a professional soccer player. And there might be a telemetry now first. Phil, correct me. Of I don't know any other professional athletes we've had on the podcast, but
I can't think of even one. So I agree.
It's a really neat thing. It's a neat especially for such a great guy. But all right, so we can move off the soccer thing. So how did you wind up at Angola Cables?
Yeah, so that's another good question, and thanks for raising that. You know, so when I was done with my school, and eventually football was nothing more for me, you know, I met my wife during holidays in Portugal, and then she told me, listen, I'm living in Angola, and I was like, I'm not moving away from the Netherlands and going back home. No, I'm not doing that. You know, I have my life over there. But when I met her, I totally decided to go back to my home country, because, you know, I was done with studies in the Netherlands. And then eventually my mother heard something about submarine cables, internet. And then she told me, hey, maybe there is something you could look into it. Right. And I was like, okay, cool. Then I tried to join to do, you know, the best of both worlds, you know, felt in love with my wife, and then eventually going back home to be with my parents, which we all left them. You know, there is one particular case in Angola, and I think many in African countries are the same thing, which is, you know, when you're going to high school, you know, then if your parents have, you know, a little bit of good conditions to send you away, they will do it, either to Portugal, either to whatever, right? For us, Portugal was the entry point because we were colonized by Portugal, so it was the obvious country to go when everybody wants to do something with high school and university up. And my way was a little bit different. I went to the Netherlands, and you know, it was totally different than the common path that everybody takes in Angola. And so yeah, when I went back to Angola, you know, I was trying to apply for work. And with an IT background, you know, the work that I just received was just, you know, help desk and all of these things, you know, in my young career, you know, that's actually what you need to do. You know, you need to have your hands dirty, you know, and doing this kind of ticketing jobs and stuff like that. But eventually, you know, I wanted something else. And when Angola Cables came into the picture, they were looking into younger generation, which could speak many languages, you know, because it would be a multinational project and so on and so forth. And then I applied, and eventually they hired me.
How long had the company Angola Cables been in existence at that point? Was it relatively new?
The company was created on paper, if I'm not mistaken, 2010, something like that. And then eventually 2011 and 12, things started happening.
Okay. Does the government, so the Angola is a country that has an oil wealth as a source of income for the government.
Right.
Is there government investment in things like Angola Cables and?
No. I mean, you know, one of the, as you mentioned, you know, aside of oil, there is a lot of another natural resources, you know, which come into play. But obviously, oil is the main source of income for the entire country. And when Angola Cables was created, was actually created by the five major shareholders, which are a joint of public and private shareholders, but mainly were public, right? So.
That was my understanding that some of that oil wealth was translated into investment into the generally right. in the IT telecommunications infrastructure, and right. then specifically to Angola Cables to underwrite this investment to build something
that.
For the country. Okay, and so then you're starting off at help desk IT 101 in Angola Cables, and at some point you're involved in the. Become involved in the building the first major submarine cable across the South Atlantic cable system. How did you get involved in that project?
Yeah, I have to be honest, you know, I think IT is a very broader No. Our industry is very broad, right? Sure. I like to use the example as a doctor, right? If you go to the hospital, you have a lot of doctors which can perform different activities of operations or whatsoever, right? And eventually, when you go back and you studied somewhere in Europe, you go back home, you know, the first question you got from your mother, hey, the printer is damaged, can you make it? You know, so in their head, it's like, okay, so he started IT, so he will fix everything. And so eventually, when we started at Angola Cables, we started working in a house, actually, because we didn't have any kind of offices. And so I was actually trying to do whatever it took to help the company, right? Because I was number 11 within the company. And oh, wow. So there was me and someone else, another guy, which had some IT skills, and we were setting everything up, the mail servers, and so on and so forth. But eventually, there was also a lack of product folks, business folks, and so on and so forth. And my first call, I have to be honest, you know, my first call I had with a international company, because we needed to buy IP transit from a tier one or tier two network back in the days. You know, when I was in the call, you know, and the guys were talking during the call, I went back home and I told my mother, I don't know which kind of secret services those are, but I never heard anything about this, you know, because the subsea industry to me was pretty new, you know, and I kind of see that back when I, for instance, I went last week to my daughter's school to give a presentation about subsea cables and blah, blah, blah. And they were like, does this exist? You know, so it's a surprise for everybody. So that was my first feeling when I joined the company and on the first meetings.
So what year roughly would that be?
What was that, Doc?
What year are we talking about?
When that was 2011. Okay, end of 2011.
I think also we have to remind. I mean, you know this very well, but just for anybody listening, like the continent of Africa connects to the global internet through submarine cables that run along the east and west coasts of the continent. But all of that is relatively new. Like the first submarine cable that went down the east coast was like 15 years ago, and prior to that, it was entirely satellite. And then there's a right. little bit more history on the west coast, but that too is not that long ago. Like we were all, you know, adults when the continent of Africa was entirely connected through satellite, which is you know, constrained capacity, high cost, high latency. And it was really a new day when these submarine cables came into being, and the satellite industry kind of collapsed around, you know, each time a landing station came alive. You know, we were watching this in routing back in 2009 when a submarine cable right. landing showed up, like in East Africa. You could just watch the everybody move off of satellite and go over to and it never came back. It wasn't even there as a dormant backup. It was just completely gone. Just trashed. So I mean, the fact that people would be like, oh, what are these things? I mean, nowadays people are still don't know what they are, but they were really, you know, only a few years old, depending on where you were in Africa. So
true. No, and just to add into that as well, Doug, you know, and whenever I do, I like to do a lot of, you know, not only professional talks, but also family and friend talks. You know, I really like to explain them what is all this all about, right? The internet that has been built for years now, you know, and all these protocols that we run on the Aussie modem whatsoever, you know, young generation nowadays, they don't want to know anything about that. The only thing they want to know is, you know, it's really, is it working? You know, right. And if not, then if you try to explain them, they will easily tell you, listen, I'm playing online, I just need to get back online again, you know. And then if eventually for us, the old schools, you know, kind of stresses me a little bit personally, right? Because I really want to try to explain you why is it not working and where is the server located or whatever the issue is, right? But eventually it is what it is. I think this Generation Z, what we call them or what they call themselves, you know, it's very into get it down now, right? They don't kind of care where is it coming from, where is it going to. But yeah, going back to your point about Africa, you know, it's relatively new. And if you're still looking into it, you know, every time I have the chance to do a talk in Angola, and I will do another one end of the year, you know, where the prime minister will be there as well. You know, I always try to do some comparisons. Obviously, they don't like to see comparisons like, you know, a European country or US country with Africa, with Angola, for instance, right? They will say, just use the same, you know, another country in Africa. And then eventually I try to do that. Like, and the example that I still use is like, look into how many cables are landing in South Africa and in Nigeria, right? And look how many cables Angola has for a 30 million population, right? I mean, you know, if you look into Portugal only, there is more than 15 cables active by now. So Portugal has 10 million people. Do you really think they are building this all of this capacity for 10 million people, whereby 60% of these 10 million people are elders? No way, right? They're just trying to make sure that the digital transformation strategy that the government or that the country has really move forward as it should be. Because, I mean, you know, what we are doing currently in Angola, you know, we are adding one cable while the other is already dying. And I give you an example. Two Africa is coming up and SAT-3 will be dead by, I don't know how many months or years from now, but it's pretty old now, right? So
SAT-3. So I'm not sure when that came into... That's the old cable that has the least amount of capacity. And so I think like when I was first doing this, you know, 15 years ago, when we see a cable cut around Africa, it just meant the country was completely offline. And I think maybe it was the Red Sea cable cuts in February 2012 that we saw, like in East Africa, cable countries would, I mean, there was a lot of connectivity that was lost, but there was actually at that point, multiple cables, and there was some element of resilience where providers could stay online through switching over to another cable, which was kind of a new thing. It was still very dependent on submarine cables. So it seemed like there was like a trend going in the right direction of increasing internet resilience. Right. But I'd be really interested in your take on you know, how far or not far we've gotten, because I think if we look at the cable cuts that took place in March off the coast of Cote d'Ivoire, there was an incident. As our understanding is, there was some sort of like undersea landslide or some kind of thing that happened on the seafloor, and it took out four cables, which is a lot of cables, and really messed up a lot of connectivity up and down the east coast. West coast of Africa. And what was interesting to me is, you know, in all this time, obviously there's been a lot of submarine cables have been built that's improved kind of international connectivity resilience. There's also a big movement with, you know, content and local hosting and stuff and things moving into the countries. But it's interesting to hear when those cables went down, like in Nigeria, there were payment systems that wouldn't work anymore, and all kinds of like local services were no longer working. And it does make you wonder, like, so what are those dependencies that we haven't been able to move into the country? It seems like we still have, despite all the cables and despite all the local, you know, coasting, local caching of content, we still have a lot of, you know, the countries still maintain a lot of dependencies on things that are accessed through the submarine cables. I don't know. Is that just how is it going to be, or is there? I don't know if that's a you know, if we're going to get to a point where, you know, a cable could go down and most services are still accessible. Except for those, it seems like there ought to be things like I think it was like, you know, there's like some authoritative DNS, you know, things. You find all these, you discover all these dependencies you didn't know you had once you lost the connection, and it turned out, you know, like there's like a payment service that authoritative DNS was back in Europe, and now it's unreachable, and now everybody's things, even though this is a service that really is just used in Nigeria, it doesn't operate, and it's like some of these things are solvable, but we still have this. I don't know. Maybe that's just something we're still working through. I don't know. Do you have any opinions on that arc, that evolution, as you've seen it?
Yeah, I think you very briefly touched into multiple points, and I will get back into the DNS stuff in a few minutes ago. But you know, obviously, when those kind of things happen, obviously that you know multiple factors will then be analyzed, as you guys normally do at Kentik as well. You know, and everybody tries to do kind of analysis to understand what it went wrong and what can we do to avoid future impacts such as these ones. Going back to March 2024, you know, I think that was the time when Equiano came to rescue, isn't it? Right?
It is. So right. Equiano is the Google cable that survived, and it was also because it was relatively new, it had probably the largest amount of capacity. Well, there's a couple things that came to the rescue. So Equiano is probably number one. Number two is the Saks cable. So this is the cable, you know, the Darwin was involved in building a cable directly across the South Atlantic from Angola to Brazil. We still got to talk about that story. But that gives them the option then to, instead of, you know, the primary path for traffic is to go up and down north, south, up to like Portugal, Western Europe. But then you've got this, you know, direct shot over to Brazil where you can kind of like, ricochet off Fortaleza up to the west coast or the east coast of the United States. I got my east west mixed up today. And so I could see from a routing perspective that shift of going to, you know, through, you know, from losing the connectivity from one of those cables that was cut and then going out to the to Brazil. And then even the Sail cable, which was a competitor to Saks, this is the Chinese-backed, was it South Atlantic? What does this stand for? Internet?
Yeah, I'm not quite sure.
I don't know what Sail stands for. Okay, but that goes to Cameroon. So that goes from Fortaleza to Cameroon. Right. And that too, we could see traffic shifting. So mm-hmm. I think Equiano probably gets the number one credit. Saks maybe number two, Sail also took on. We can see Camtel and Cameroon switching to going through Cogent, which I didn't realize they were buying Cogent in Fortaleza. But you could see it like, from trace routes. You could see that you're going across this. Yeah. So,
Whatever the credits are, dog, you know, it's good to emphasize here to our listeners as well. You know, I actually, exactly what you described, you know, was exactly what happened, right? Because when we are, I you know, one of the words that I would like to normally use, you know, back then when I'm in Angola, and my mother says, oh, the internet is so slow, the internet is so poor, and blah, blah, blah. I keep telling them, listen, a few years back, we totally would be dark. On dark, right? But now we still can survive. You still can do your own stuff, rather with a lot of issues, right? No internet banking systems or whatever, as you mentioned in Nigeria, but you still can send a message over WhatsApp at least, and it will come through with the X amount of delays or whatever it is, right? But I had a very good friend of mine. He runs an ISP in DRC, Kinshasa. And then eventually he told me, Darren, listen, I'm in a huge problems because, you know, the country's almost dark and I need to have some connectivity. And whatever he did, you know, as a human beings, I think we start getting innovative, you know, and we start looking into possibilities, whether it's Equiano or Saks or Sail or whatever, just to have your own people online, right? And so what he did was funny enough. So he had a deal with Angola Cables, if I remember correctly, and then he went through Angola and from Angola to Fortaleza. And from Fortaleza, funny enough, he didn't went to US, but he went with the Ellalink back to Lisbon.
Wow.
Right. So we were looking into the latency perspective and he said, you know what? Listen, the latency might be better going through North America, going from Fortaleza all the way up to Lisbon. It doesn't really matter because people are online now. That's what I wanted to make sure about it, right? So my customers at the end of the day, they still can surf over the internet. And it was funny enough to see that, you know, because at the end of the day, as you mentioned, you know, are we there already? I don't think we are there already because if we look into the major markets in Africa where a lot of content and cloud service providers are going to. It's South Africa, Nigeria, and Kenya, right? Even them sometimes do face issues when there is a cable cut, right? So do I like to see something different in the future? Hell yeah. I think we all would love to see that, right? But at the end of the day, I think there is so many autonomous system numbers involved in making all of this happening, you know, that it really takes, you know, an hard bite to make, you know, everybody, you know, first of all, trying to localize. There is a enable data center, available data centers with enough power, you know, to serve the CDNs. And then the CDNs do have a strategy to serve that specific country or region locally and so on and so forth. You know, in Angola, eventually, as far as I'm concerned, we only have caching solutions so far. Well, that was better than nothing, because back in 2011, you know, a price per megabit in Angola for the end user used to be $700.
Wow.
Back in 2011. And I don't want to do any kind of spoiler over here, but I'm just writing a book about that, you know, about the decay of internet in Angola, you know. And that's one of the chapters I would like to emphasize, because, you know, people, end users always tend to say, oh, the price per megabit is too high, it's too high. It goes lower. Obviously, we cannot compare ourselves, for instance, with Portugal or with you know, Ashbourne or whatever the place is, because those markets, we are talking about mature markets, right? So if we eventually, on also basis, we went from, I don't know, at 250 bucks per megabit down to 23 or down to 20 now, it's an improvement, right? Over the last decade, I would say.
Let me add, for people who don't speak this language, in the United States, like this is in the wholesale market of transit, you do quotes like this of just like how much you pay by volume of how much traffic, and there's usually a meg month is the term, and what's the cost for a meg month? And in the United States, I don't know, maybe like 15 years ago, across below a dollar was kind of like the going rate. It's like the gallon of gas kind of metric. So we got below a dollar. I don't know what it is now. I mean, it's like 10 cents or something. I don't know. It's going to be something really small in the United States. But in a lot of developing parts of the world, like Darwin's saying, this is $700 a meg month. I remember hearing like South Pacific Islands pay for satellite and be like $1,500 meg month. So that's 1,500 times the cost for the transit. I mean, it's like outrageously expensive. And, you know, there's reasons why. There's definitely been parts of the world. All these prices are going down all over the world, but but there's still like there's been some huge disparities, like of multiple orders of magnitude, like in this example.
True. True. And all of this, thanks for translating that into a normal language, Doug. I think it's very important for our listeners. But at the end of the day, it all comes down with, you know, how mature is the market, you know, what's the strategy, what's the country strategy, you know, to becoming even more digital. And, you know, obviously, you know, when I saw all of that, I told my CEO back then in Angola Cables, I told him, hey, listen, I think we are doing something really wrong as a country. And then he looked at me, I was very young, and he said, what you talking about it, you know? And I said, yeah, we are sending all the traffic back to Europe and then coming back again, you know, there is something else we should be doing over here. And then eventually we decided to looking in building, you know, another IXP into the country and trying to, you know, to, I called myself a priest, because I went back to all the universities, all these government institutions to tell them how good peering was and how important it was to localize traffic and so on and so forth. And eventually, if I look now back now, even when I left, you know, it still gives me some chili, you know, to see the good developments that the country has been doing. And I was surprised, you know, even to see the developments that a country that like Congo Kinshasa is also doing, you know, because we don't tend to look into those markets until there is an event happening in there, and then someone is showing the slides and showing what did we had a decade ago and what do we have now, you know. And I think this, all of this will help us out, you know, as a continent to go into the next level, which then means, you know, entrepreneurs will then, instead of, you know, hosting everything outside, they will, you know, maybe utilize or use local clouds which are available in certain regions and countries, you know, and try to do a failover, you know, maybe I can just leave, you know, something that I'm doing on a code in country and then having a plan B somewhere outside, you know.
So Darwin, you mentioned you know, the price, this price of transit when it's very high, it's a illiberal market. And some of this has to do with like the infrastructure you're talking about of like what's been constructed of like, how do you even have the technical means to keep the traffic local, but equally important, and maybe there's other ingredients that I'm not thinking of, but there's equally important is usually a telecommunications regulator. So the government gets involved as well. Sure. And usually the role of the regulator is to take the incumbent, whoever is the dominant player, usually in most countries, in nearly every country at some point, the incumbent was the former state telecom founded and possibly still owned by the government. And every country is on a similar path where they fall of just trying to liberalize the market, trying to privatize this, create competition to improve service, lowers price. And but in every country, you have a situation where the incumbent still, maybe they've been partially or completely privatized, but they still have an outside influence. And it's kind of not in their favor to do this traffic localization because it helps the their competitors more than it helps them, even if it does help the country.
And so then
you need a regulator that comes in and says, hey, incumbent, you don't have a choice. We're going to force you to connect domestically, and they're going to complain, and that helps create a more vibrant market. And so I think, and, you know, aside from, you know, building the infrastructure, there's also the kind of like this legal government role, and it's often a mark of how the strength of a regulator of a country, if the regulator is strong, is able to make the incumbent make all this domestic connectivity, then that's a strong regulator. There's countries that have fairly weak regulators and they are in the other direction where the incumbent still just runs roughshod over the country at the expense of the people in the country, regardless of, you know, whether the exchanges were built or not. But anyway, it's a
I can see myself in what you just mentioned, you know, because in the beginning, definitely, you know, the two larger networks of the country in Angola were not exchanging traffic with each other, and so this traffic has been exchanged in Portugal for whatever reason, right? And there is a process that obviously it's like you said, Doug, it's not only about building the infrastructure, because obviously we, you know, with some knowledge and with some, you know, people which are willing to do so, we're going to do it anyway, right? But it's also a part of education, right? And so this part of the education was, to me, was one of the most hardest to do, you know, but it was rewarding at the end of the day, you know, when you see actually that they are peering locally, exchanging traffic locally, and no end user traffic is going abroad and then coming back again, you know. So it just gives you a feeling of proudness in a way. But like you said, you know, the regulator should be, you know, should be educated, and the regulator should also, I would say, not only asking questions but also see the benefits for this for a specific country, right? And so one of the things I'm fighting now, just very quickly, aside of DKX, I do a lot of volunteering activities, but it's just to, you know, to increase the IPv6 utilization. And obviously, you might see everywhere, right? Everybody will say, oh, but we are very slow into that as a world, as a country, and blah, blah, blah. But eventually, you know, I think Brazil does a very good job on that, especially the guys from NIC.br. They do have a lot of educational videos on YouTube, or, you know, courses about how to deploy IPv6 and so on and so forth. And one of the things I was pushing the operators in a Telegram group, together also with the regulator, was telling them, listen, we shouldn't be behind Gabon, for example, because Gabon is doing a very good job. And how do I confront them with I confront them with data, right? With stats. And if we look into Gabon, which is right next door, they are doing an awesome job. Things are going as it should be, right? Maybe on a lower pace comparing to United States or Brazil or countries in Europe. But hey, we do have our own pace, right? And so eventually I was bombarding them and still bombarding them everywhere, Twitter, everywhere I can, right? And so eventually now I'm seeing, you know, a development, and Unitel, which is the largest mobile operator, they are doing now deployments at the end users with the on-premises routers, you know, modems to the end users with IPv6 enabled already, which is actually phenomenal. And I'm really looking forward to my trip to Angola end of the year to meet these guys and tell them, listen, you guys are doing a great job, you know, and since you guys are doing, maybe the other smaller ones and medium ones will follow your path, right? That's what we expect for everybody.
Yeah. Hey, so I want to make sure we have time to talk about the Saks cable too. So mm-hmm. I want to set the scene. So this is back in, I guess the cable came active in maybe September 2018, I think. But in that time and the couple of years leading up to it, there was kind of a race, a bit of a competition between who was going to build the first cable. There was maybe three projects, right? There was a SAEX cable that never ended up happening. There was the Saks cable that Angola Cables led, and Darwin, you were involved in that sale from the Chinese. Sale ended up was built. They claimed that they had built the cable first, although at the time I was at, let's see, this was 2018. Dyn would have been bought by Oracle, so we were Oracle Internet Intelligence. We could see it was very easy for us to confirm when Saks came active. We couldn't see any impact for sale. I'm not sure exactly when that it is active now. I'm not sure when that happened, but from our perspective, Saks was the first one. But Darwin, like you and I had already been chatting about this, and you sent me a message. And he's like, you should check your stats, because I think, you know, the cable's up. And I've been looking for it, because at that point I had already kind of spotted a few cables and gotten some press. It kind of became a hobby of mine. It still is to this day, of trying to find noteworthy cables and see if I can publish the first evidence of their use, starting with the Alba One cable to Cuba. Anyway, so you gave me this tip. I went and looked, and I was like, oh, we've got, you know, it's striking. It's striking. We had measurement servers in Brazil. We measured to providers in Angola, and all of a sudden it went from 300 milliseconds to 100 or less. I don't remember with the numbers, but you know, it's no longer going, you know, up to North America, across the North Atlantic, and back down. There's a direct path now that didn't exist. There's no way that can happen without, that wasn't possible prior to the activation. But you sent me a message then, and you're like, so then I started publishing this, and then you sent a message like, you're like, oh, I don't think I was supposed to tell you. I mean, all is forgiven, and it's a great accomplishment, and everybody's happy, but you're like, give me some color here. Tell me what happened.
I mean, you know, when you are on the edge of the seeing things like those, you know, when you are so involved in making it happen, you know, and when you see this coming into reality, it's even more, you know, more rewarding. And I think the first thing I did, and Lacnik was right on the corner, if I'm not mistaken. And I pinged Doug, and I said, hey, I think we got a case over here, you know. But funny enough, let me go back in time, you know. So I was traveling from Luanda to Fortaleza, because I told my colleagues in Fortaleza I want to see the evidence from the first packets from Africa to Brazil. And eventually when I arrived at the airport, you know, they were receiving a lot of pressure from the CTO, you know, back then. And the CTO was like, no, we need to activate now. And they were saying, no, we are still doing some configs and blah, blah, blah. But they were waiting on me. And then eventually I arrived at the cable landing station, and everybody, Dario, where were you at? I said, I wasn't on the plane, you know. And then they said, let's do that, because the CTO is calling us like hell, you know. And then eventually we did a commit, you know. We saw the first packets going router to router between the two countries. And it was like, you know, mind-blowing. It was just like crazy, you know. And looking into the latency decrease, you know, was just something special, I would say. And then eventually I pinged Doug and I said, hey, listen, like we were both at Lacnik, if I'm not mistaken. We were going to Lacnik. I can remember in Rosario.
It was just before Lacnik. So we're both going to Lacnik in Rosario, Argentina, but it was it was like a week prior or something.
Nice.
So we break the story, or at least, you know, confirm, you know, publish the first evidence of the Sachs cable, say, you know, as far as we're concerned, this is the first operational cable across the South Atlantic. And then we meet up at in Rosario, Argentina. And then we did a little lightning talk together. Darwin talked about the project, the benefits and stuff. And then I just went through the what we could see from an internet measurement standpoint. And anyway, it was a cool.
Doug, what was the actual difference in latency that you observed?
Yeah, I'm trying to remember. Maybe we can find here. I it's something like, you know, a reduction in from maybe 300 to 100 milliseconds. Let me see if I can pull
it up.
It
was, in either way, was more than 200 milliseconds in latency reduction.
Wow.
Because from Angola to Fortaleza, it's like 63 milliseconds. And then if you go down to South Africa, you add 30 more milliseconds. So you end up into 90 something, right? Mm-hmm. Depending on where you go, Cape Town or Johannesburg. So, yeah. So it was
so it's pretty dramatic.
Yeah. Yeah,
because we'll put it in show notes. We have some graphs of the improvement.
I still have some slides. I don't have with me in here because right after the talk with Doug, I went to Brazil during the Brazilian Infrastructure Week, and we were doing some kind of analysis on online gamers in South Africa and what the benefits were for them, right? And so they said, actually, you know, it's actually easier for us to go to Brazil than going all the way up to Europe because we have a reduction on latency. And so for the gamers, it was something, you know, something cool to be, you know, because when you are playing online, you know, it's always critical, right? That a player doesn't get charged just because of latency.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
And so yeah, that's maybe we can just see into whatever we have Doug on the graphs. I still have something, and then we can
there's links to the slides and stuff, and I've got my thanks to the Internet Archive because Oracle deleted all of our stuff. We can it was 300 milliseconds to 100 milliseconds. And again, for people who don't aren't used to these, you know, speaking in these terms, across the Atlantic is maybe 70, 80 milliseconds. Across the Pacific Ocean is like 100 milliseconds round trip. So 300 milliseconds is pretty far, but it would make sense to drop to about 100 milliseconds to get between Brazil and Angola, and such a thing was not possible prior to 2018.
Yeah, especially when you, because, you know, Doug and Phil, your questions might be, so, okay, what was, I wouldn't speak for others, but to myself, what was one of the motivations that we built this cable and we had a huge investment on that? I mean, obviously, first of all, you know, why should we be dependent on Europe or on US to go to Brazil? Secondly, we do speak the same language and we consume a lot of Brazilian content because, you know, if even nowadays I'm sitting in Europe now and if my daughter looks up into a content, Portuguese content, the first thing she gets on YouTube is Brazilian content because those guys, you know, they just generate content dramatically, right? So there is no actually, you know, I would say, you know, visible content in Portuguese from Portugal. Portuguese from Angola, we have something, you know, which is more music related to it. But from Brazil is everything. I mean, it's music, it's video games, it's like telenovelas, you know, which our parents and grandparents used to consume a lot, you know, and eventually all of this, you know, got even better. But obviously the end users, they won't notice that immediately like we do, right, on this industry. But, you know, eventually we did something good for both countries, I would say, because neither we and neither Brazil had direct connection and we couldn't exchange traffic in a more direct way than we are doing nowadays.
So what's next? What's your next project for DKIX? What are you working on in your role now?
Oh yeah, so that's a good question. I think you guys might have seen everything on the news, but I was involved in trying to open a new market, and we announced that we are going into the biggest market in Latin America, which is Brazil. So yeah, Brazil it will be. That's what I'm putting my focus nowadays into it.
So DKIX is opening an exchange in
São Paulo? And Rio. São Paulo and Rio, yes.
Okay.
Yes.
You're going to try to connect to the SACs, your colleagues at Angola Cables, or your ex-colleagues?
Sure, it's an option. Why not? Right?
Sure.
Yeah, it's an option.
So when are those slated to be active?
We are working hard to get everything at least ready by next year, March, during Capacity LATAM. So yeah, we're hoping to push the horses as far as they can go, you know, because as you guys might know or not know, and our audience might also not know, but yeah, shipping equipment to Brazil might be a hard thing to do. Yeah. But yeah, we are going, running against the time.
Sure. Awesome.
So Darwin, how do you see, actually Doug, you as well, since your background, how do you see the evolution of the internet, you know, over this last decade, right? The last 10 years since, you know, maybe 2014, 2015. And like, how do you see trends and technologies changing?
No, oh, good. You know, I think at the end of the day, we all have different perspectives, right? But, you know, everything we do in our industry, I always like to correlate that into whatever we do in our personal lives. And, you know, again, you know, I think I said that before, but the way we build the internet, at least for my knowledge, and at least from what I can see, what is coming towards us, is that we build an internet for a single purpose, which was exchanging traffic among different networks, different autonomous system numbers, right? And eventually we wanted to make sure that the packets were delivered and were sent. Nowadays, we are talking about those, you know, new generation, those new kids doing a lot of stuff over the internet, right? This internet that has been built with certain standards and certain protocols, right? Which nowadays, maybe this young generation, they don't give a care about it. But it's always good to mention that whenever we have the chance to do so. But when we speak about, you know, artificial intelligence, you know, crypto mining, all of those stuff, you know, and then you tend to realize when you're sitting on a couch and have your coffee or whatever, your beer, you know, during the weekend, and then if you just realize how much power we will need to serve all of that, you know, how many queries on ChatGPT are being made on a daily basis or on a hour basis, you know, then I tend to ask myself the question, can we handle all of that? Will we be able to handle all of that? Maybe yes, maybe we'll. But as Doug mentioned before as well, you know, we are talking about different maturity in different markets, you know. In Europe and US, we nowadays, we only talk about artificial intelligence and so on and so forth. But in Africa or parts of South America, we're still struggling with basic connectivities, right? That's why we also see projects like Starlink going down and trying to increase the internet penetration of those countries because the fiber is not on their doors. And if the fiber is on their doors, they cannot afford to pay it. Either they need to choose whether they pay an internet connectivity or either they buy food, right? So we are talking here about different scales, which I normally like just to bring up, you know, for our own sanity, because many times we tend to forget, right? Everything is going so quickly that we tend to forget, you know, that basic things also needs to still tackled, you know. Mm-hmm. Then I will hand over to Doug to his thoughts about.
I guess I would mention I would think there's like two things. So, you know, again, focusing on the continent of Africa, and some of this relates to other places as well. But you know, in this time, in the 15 plus years now, we have lots of submarine cables instead of just zero, then one or two, and now we've got multiple going down each coast. So that's obviously a net positive. What is kind of interesting, though, and I think was maybe not so foreseen, was the fact that nowadays when there's a cable cut, it's a multi-cable cut. You know, like it's not, we put in more cables, and now when there's an incident, it's more cables that are broken. And part of this has to do with geological stuff. So there's this, you know, Congo Canyon that has these landslides that go, you know, 100 kilometers or something outrageously, you know, long, take on multiple cables. It's very hard to engineer around some of this when you have an incident on the seafloor that's going to span, you know, enormous distances. And the incident in March in West Africa was another one where you have multiple cables, four cables getting broken in a single incident. So I'm talking to a reporter from the New York Times who's working on a story on this of just, you know, more cables does sometimes equate to more cables getting cut when there's a incident such as one of these. So it doesn't necessarily buy you, completely solve the problem.
Right.
And there's only so much geographic, diversity. Equiano got some, maybe by accident, just being a little farther away from the problems of both the Congo Canyon and the Ivory Coast incidents. But anyway, it's interesting, these, more cables equals more cables getting cut thing. So it's a net positive, but it's not without its snags. And then and the other dimension, like the local hosting, one thing, back to, the question about like these local services that were not working, even though you had, some of this stuff ought to be able to work completely locally. There's another phenomenon that I wasn't aware of until I met some folks in South Africa, from South Africa. I was at Apricot in Thailand in February, and we were chatting because there had been another submarine cable cut. And there, the poor folks down in South Africa, I guess Angola is a little bit in this boat as well, where every time there's a cable cut, that's a long distance back to Europe. And if anything breaks along the way, they suffer. Like they just, and there may be lots of cables, and when multiple cables break, they struggle to maintain the quality of service. I mean, they're staying online, but this, it's a matter of quality of service. But one of the phenomenon that's interesting that I didn't know about was that, we were having this conversation, well, what about all this localization? You have this local content, can't you just get your, Netflix from the local server now? I get your, and you're like, you would think so, but there's a lot of times when it's happening is, this local, so say it's, a CDN, pick your CDN, it's got its local cache of all this content. Those caches, if they don't have a great connection back to home base, because say there's a submarine cable cut, they may drain themselves and just take themselves out of operation, which kind of compounds the problem. So in South Africa, there's content local, but it's being taken out of service because the local content service, like CDN nodes, can't get a quality connection back to home base. So they just take themselves out of service. So then all these folks in South Africa now have to use, instead of using the local content, they are pushed onto the cable [S2] Right. [S1] Links that are now, having problems. And it's a weird thing. So we've made a lot of progress and things have gotten a lot better, but when we run into some rough patch, it doesn't, there's some problems still to solve there, where in both these, the submarine cable connectivity, local hosting, local caching stuff, each one, it's a net positive. We've grown and evolved, but there's a lot of challenges still to try to, maintain quality of service when you have some, catastrophic technical failures.
Yeah, and then again, I think this might be a global thing, right? You mentioned a couple of times the world phenomenons, right, happening in our industry. We were chatting about it, about the Netflix fight, Jack Paul and Mike Tyson, and I was suffering when I was in Europe, right, just to get a good connectivity to watch the fight, the last match. But in Angola, they were watching that fight without any issues, and they were making fun of
wow.
me, and I was like, okay, so there is something wrong going on here, right? So
I think in that case, so we're talking about the what was it, Jake Paul, Mike Tyson, kind of ridiculous fight. Spectacle fight. I tried to watch some of this too. It wasn't working so well for me, but it seemed like it really came down to each provider, how you connect it to Netflix, and because
right.
Netflix is just a single entity that only they have their own CDN that they exclusively use. That's one of the theories floated of why people were having problems was per service provider. If you didn't have a lot of ways to connect to Netflix, or if you were trying to squeeze too much traffic through a constrained link, then you would have problems. Some service providers had very few problems. Some had a lot of problems, but it did seem like the fact that there's, it's just as one CDN, as opposed to most events, content events these days are split across multiple content providers. Even when Amazon Prime Video does Thursday Night Football, you'd think, oh, it must just be all AWS. And it's not the case. They split that against competing content providers or cloud providers to spread out the load. And I don't know, I guess that too occasionally suffers from its glitches, but at least it's on. So that was one unique aspect of the Netflix case. But that's wild that the folks in Angola were watching that's that with no problem. I'm glad they gave you some ribbing for that.
True. Yeah, no, I, you know, just to finish, to sum up, you know, I think like old Doug also mentioned, you know, it comes up with, you know, so many factors, so many analyses, so many stakeholders, you know, that eventually whenever we think we are safe, you know, we might not be, you know. And, you know, and going back into this incident from March 24, I think, you know, those cables that were impacted, you know, and Akiano from Google was not, you know, I think it's also important for the guys who are building those cables, you know, to kind of doing a different desktop survey than the ones who are already laid down,
yeah,
right? And maybe just try to avoid that for the future. That's one thing I could think of as well, you know.
So Darwin, you gave your thoughts about the evolution of internet. I gave a couple about submarine cables and content providers. So would you, how would you describe DKIC's role in this, you know, the evolution of the internet, and what role does it play?
Yeah, I think, you know, as we all know, you know, an internet exchange point is a crucial component of our industry, right? Because we need to make sure that we can, you know, we can have networks connected. They can exchange traffic in a secure way and faster way. And I think what we are doing at DKIC, you know, it's not obviously trying to go everywhere, which doesn't make sense. But one of the things we have on our DNA is if we go somewhere, is really to try to solve a problem, right? A problem that might have been identified by external or internal stakeholders. And we always try to, you know, just to have a different conversations with the local community to understand, hey, does it really make sense for us to come in, or can we work together with the IXP local IXP to make things better, like we did in Switzerland, right, where we have a partnership with SwissIX, where we do the technical part and they do the business strategy and so on and so forth. But it all comes down into which problem are we trying to solve as a company, right? And if we can do that, you know, on a medium large scale, I think this is beneficial for each and every network connected to our platform, and also at the end of the day for the end users, because they, at the end of the day, we all end users, right? When we are sitting on our couches at home with the family and enjoying something on the web, right? And so that's what we are at DKIC normally do, right? And for example, you might ask, so why Brazil? Eventually, you know, Brazil was a market which took us a little bit longer time because we needed really to do a deep dive and assessment, because IXBR is doing a tremendous good job as being the largest internet exchange point in the world. But obviously, you know, there are kind of components where we can aggregate some value, because at DKIC we don't focus ourselves only on peering, but we do have more than just peering, right? Like the closed user groups, blackhauling on route service, or, you know, enterprise networks which are coming on board. And again, it's all about educating, right? We now tend to help those enterprise networks to come on board and also to be able to speak BGP, because most of them, they don't do that, right? And eventually we started all off with this in Germany. And what we trying to do is trying to replicate this and try to educate these enterprise guys what the benefits of peering or of an IXP might be for them and for their business at the end of the day.
Gentlemen, it's been a real pleasure to have you, Doug, as usual, and Darwin, getting to hear some of your history, especially, of course, your personal history and your experience in professional sports. That was really interesting. But of course, working in the submarine telecom cable space, which is something that I've been interested in over the past few years here, working at Kentek as well. So thanks so much for joining today.
Thank you, guys. I really appreciate it. And yeah, looking forward to the podcast when it comes available.
Absolutely. So for now, if you are interested in coming on Telemetry Now as a guest, or if you have an idea for a podcast, I'd love to hear from you. Please reach out at telemetrynow@kentik.com. So for now, thanks so much for listening. Bye-bye.